Good afternoon, everyone. This is Barry Mandinac. I'm Executive Vice President and Head of Distribution at Virtus Investment Partners. I want to welcome you to the Virtus High Yield Update call featuring Michael Kirkpatrick. Michael is Managing Director and Senior Portfolio Manager at Sykes Investment Advisors. Mike is the lead portfolio manager for Sykes' high yield strategies, and these include the Sykes High Yield Fund, the Sykes High Income Fund, and the Sykes High Yield Wrap Strategy. Mike, I want to welcome you and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Why don't I hit you with a few questions to get the conversation started, and then we'll turn it over to the field and see if there are others in the outside that would like to ask you questions as well. My first question is about the flows to the high yield category. It's an interesting time frame. We've seen since the bottom of the market, the March lows in the equity markets, we've seen historic flows into fixed income, historic outflows out of equity funds. And within fixed income, high yield has had some notable real flows going. To what do you attribute the high yield opportunity attracting so much money these days?
Sure. So the flows have generally, the technicals for the market have been fairly positive, especially after April 9th when we received the details of the Federal Reserve's various programs. But I think one of the big drivers is there's, you know, certainly we believe there's meaningful diversification benefits of the high-yield asset class. On the one hand, it has a low correlation to other fixed-income asset classes, and there's some good reasons for that. Usually, an improving economy, rates are rising, and high-yield, the underlying fundamentals of the issuers is improving, so you get the spread compression to offset the rise in rates and still generate some solid total return. The highest correlation with high yield is among, or it has a higher correlation with equities. And so we looked at high yield versus large cap equities and small cap equities. And going back to the early 80s, high yield offers a similar return profile, but with less volatility, actually outperformed slightly the small cap equity. So the high yield generated a higher return per unit of risk. And something that I think is really important, especially for asset allocators as people get closer to retirement age, over rolling periods, high yield had a return only 5%. And this is compared to large cap equities, 14%, and small cap, 11%. So, and it throws off that coupon, so you constantly have that income working for you, that coupon working for you. So, I think that is, you know, people are understanding the resilience of the asset class and the diversification benefits. So, I think that's a big reason we've seen the flows.
So, Mike, if I'm a financial advisor, my client is in need of growth, we're in a low-return world, people are saying there's the demise of the 60-40 portfolio, but I can't necessarily take a retired or near-retired investor who tends to be a little more risk-averse and go from 60-40 to 80-20 with equities. That may be asking them to be somebody they're incapable of being. What ways can high yield play a role in a portfolio construction whereby I'm trying to pursue decent returns for these investors without subjecting them to the full impact of the equity markets?
Well, let me give you some statistics in the second quarter, and it gets to where we have found the best opportunities. But in the second quarter, the ICE B of A U.S. High Yield Index was up 9.6%. The ICE B of A U.S. Distressed High Yield Index was up 19.5%, which is what you would expect. Coming out of a very dislocated market, that more distressed part is going to do well. But the composite rating for that universe is triple C. So, and that's the universe that is going to see the greatest percentage of defaults. And the defaults can result in permanent loss of capital. So distressed high yield up 19.5%. The Bloomberg Barclays U.S. High Yield Fallen Angel 3% Capped Index up 20.5%. That's a double B composite rating. Just for comparison purposes, the S&P 500 was up 20.5%. So equities up the same amount. And then I looked at the highest spread triple B bonds, U.S. corporate triple B bonds, took out anything with a one-year maturity, the 20%, the top fifth spread, that and ran that index, set that as a new index. So we call that kind of the potential fallen angel universe. That in the second quarter was up 20%. So we think it's the best of all, you know, we're generating equity-like returns, and we're doing it higher in the capital structure with lower default risk. So if a company really goes bad, the equity goes to zero. Generally, certainly for bigger, larger, higher quality companies, the recovery should be higher. But we're avoiding, you know, the likelihood of default for that kind of crossover triple B and the fallen angel universe is much lower than distressed high yield. So we can get equity-like returns, we think, with higher in the capital structure without taking the same amount of credit risk.
Yeah, so for that investor who has been on the sidelines during this historic rally from the low where equities are up 50% plus from the March lows, they need to rebuild their risk position for long-term objectives, but feel like the market's advanced too quickly. High yield could be, is what you're saying, a more prudent way to rebuild risk than just long-only equities alone. Is that what you're saying? I think so.
I think that's a great way to put it. And the flip, the other side of that is, if your equity portfolio's run, taking some chips off the table, locking in those profits, and still participating in the upside with less downside, we fit from that side as well.
No, that's a great point. Another thing, you know, we witnessed high yield spreads were, you know, super wide after the March dislocation, and we were out there talking quite a bit about the attractive relative valuations. I know spreads have narrowed since then. Where are they now, and do you still consider this to be an attractive entry point for high-yield investors?
We do. So spreads are still more than 40 basis points wide of their long-term median. So there's, you know, to get back to median, we still have some spread compression. But what you get in this kind of environment, too, is with all the fallen angels coming in that tend to be higher quality companies, and we are going to go through a default cycle, so there is some cleansing at the lower end. The riskiest companies default and get out of the high-yield universe. There is an upgrade ultimately to once we get to a normal economy, there should be the asset class should be improved in quality. So you touched on the point about global demand for yield. High yield sticks out in that conversation. So, you know, we continue to think that we're going to see flows, and the fundamentals for the asset class are, we'll call them mixed for the asset class, but there's, as we know, there's a lot of sectors that are significantly benefiting from what we're going through. The home building sector, any stay-at-home activities, you know, boats, RVs, fishing equipment, you know, social, healthy social distancing, stay at home or close to home activities are doing very well. Those sectors are doing very well. We saw Target report today, not a high yield company, but you can see some of the reallocation of dollars. So there's you know, meaningful portions of the high yield market that the fundamentals are doing very well. So valuations, we can still tighten, fundamentals are doing well, and the technicals should remain solid, we think. We had a little hiccup this week with some outflows and strong issuance in the market, but there's a seasonality effect that actually I think could give investors a short-term opportunity in the asset class. But looking longer term, we're in the repair phase of the balance sheet. Technicals should remain firm.
What do you think about this conversation? I know a lot of advisors I speak with are trying to effectively time when to get into high yield, trying to figure out the entry point relative to the historic spreads and so forth. If you're a long-term allocator to the asset class for a typical individual investor who needs long-term exposure to high yield, how do you feel about that whole exercise?
It's very difficult. And now I know in the equity market, and I'm sure it's less critical in the high yield market, but still important. You know, if you miss the five best days of the year for equities, you know, your equity performance looks significantly worse. Now, you know, we have that coupon working for you. I think that the best way to think about it is to go with a money manager that actively manages the portfolio and can truncate the downside and capture the opportunities on the upside, because, you know, that's how you generate those, you know, superior returns through the credit cycle. So I think it's very difficult to time it. I think it should be a core part of the allocation, and let the active manager figure out based on what they see in the market and the individual opportunities.
Okay.
I think it's just too difficult to do anything else.
No, thank you for that point. I think that's very helpful. You had mentioned Fallen Angels. If you could kind of walk me through the case for Fallen Angels and also define what they are and why investors should care about this whole idea of Fallen Angels.
Sure. So a Fallen Angel is a bond that, when it was issued, had an investment grade rating and was subsequently downgraded into high yield. Okay, the flip side of that is a bond that was in high yield, it becomes a rising star, gets upgraded to investment grade. So, but a Fallen Angel, originally issued high yield, or investment grade, falls into high yield. And if we did quite a bit of work in this space, because we find it an attractive place for investment given our investment process. But so we went back to inception of the index, which is January 1, 1997. And looked at all rolling 12-month periods. And the Fallen Angel Index outperformed originally issue high yield and the full high yield market in 75% of rolling 12-month periods using monthly data. That percentage improves to 94% of the time when looking at three-year performance periods. And then if you just look at the annual returns over any reasonable time frame, you can see that the total return for the Fallen Angel universe beats originally issue high yield and the full high yield market by quite a bit. So it's just one of those areas that seems to fall through the cracks. I think I know in this environment it's getting a lot more attention, but historically it falls through the cracks, I think, for a lot of high yield managers, and we're focused on it and believe it gives us a, you know, it's a good pond to be fishing in, and gives you a performance tailwind over time. But it does require active management. You need to overlay a good credit process to make sure you're identifying the companies that are experiencing a near-term cyclical issue that can be fixed.
Okay, now that's helpful, and I appreciate that. I think I'll ask one more question before we open it up to the field and see if there are any questions there. And this is one where I'm shamelessly promoting you, because you probably are not as comfortable doing that as I am. But when I look at the Virtus Sykes High Yield Fund, which is the symbol is SAMHX, with the caveat that, of course, past performance is no guarantee of future results, and we know that. The question, I look at this fund and I say it's top decile returns for the past 1-3 years, top quartile for the past 5 and 10 years compared to the Morningstar peers. More importantly, on a 10-year basis, I see below average risk and above average return per Morningstar. From your perspective, what makes this fund compelling in the high yield space? What do you think an advisor should be looking for if deciding to allocate to a high yield manager? What aspects, what characteristics should they be seeking, and why do you feel that this fund has those characteristics?
Yeah, thank you for that. So I think that the critical piece is that we have an investment philosophy that prioritizes the preservation of client capital with a focus on total return. So when we entered 2020, our outlook for 2020 did not include a pandemic that would cause a hard stop to the economy. But we were not identifying a lot of value. So we just had a portfolio that was more defensively positioned. This was not a top-down view of the world. It was where valuations were. We were staying close to home. And then when, during the course of March, hard stop to the economy due to the pandemic, there was panic in the markets. And we had a significant amount of dry powder to be able to pivot to these opportunity sets that we're talking about, the Fallen Angels, the BBB universe. So we If you look at our performance versus our benchmark in the first quarter, which is a down market, we outperformed in the down market. And then we were able to pivot in late March and early April and then outperform again in the second quarter, which was an up market. And we did it in a way that we believe we didn't take a significant amount of credit were at risk versus the overall market. So we did it in the Fallen Angels, more double B in this crossover triple B space. So we like to think that, you know, an active manager should to some degree be a shock absorber to the overall market. But when you look over a credit cycle, we have superior performance. So the key is just when there's not a lot of attractive opportunities, just to sit tight and wait and be patient and wait for it to present itself. And that's how we manage, and it's the best way we think to manage through the credit cycle.
So, Michael, with that question, you have the fund has about $325 million in AUM. A lot of the funds that many FAs routinely invest in the high-yield space have multiple billions. Do you see that $325 million as being a competitive advantage for you?
It's certainly allows us to be more nimble than a lot of our competitors. And I will make that case at, you know, multiples of our size, but some have just gotten way too large that they cannot maneuver, especially in an environment like we went through that just completely caught people by surprise. They can't position for it. So they just have to ride out their portfolios and, you know, it's public knowledge what the biggest funds own. So, you know, if they try and maneuver, it's very difficult for them. So, and I think that you can see, look at our performance in the first quarter and the second quarter. And we outperformed many of them in the first quarter and then again in the second quarter. So we can pivot, we can maneuver. And I think, you know, once you get well into the double-digit billions of for your fund, there's no liquidity.
Yeah, I'll ask one last thing, because, you know, you mentioned this earlier. You have this below-average risk rating from Morningstar over 10 years. And, you know, the goal of active managers in many of the volatile asset classes that effectively are essential building blocks to a well-diversified portfolio, a good active manager is providing smoother ride access to that otherwise volatile asset class to give the advisor a kind of behavioral edge to keep their clients in their seats through thick and thin. If you could briefly describe, what do you attribute your below average risk rating to in this fund? How do you think about risk, and what do you think is the main reason behind that rating?
I think it's that investment philosophy that prioritizes the preservation of client capital and then focuses on total return. That mindset, when there's not a lot to do, then be patient and wait for something that looks cheap within your investment process. And, you know, if we go through a long period where credit differentiation is not a driver of results, you know, before the financial crisis, just every single quarter, it didn't matter, the highest yielding triple C bonds did well. We go through a period like that, we're going to underperform. But at some point, those excesses are going to get worked off, and that's when our performance is really going to look solid again, and that's when the opportunities are going to be significant. So it's just having the patience in the short term. If the market's exuberant, then it's okay to underperform for a little bit and wait for until you have significant opportunities like we saw in the month of March. And we, you know, seem to occur every 2 or 3 years post-financial crisis.
Okay. Well, that's great. Mike, I want to thank you for sharing your insights and your observations. What I'd like to do now is ask the operator to open it up to the audience and see if there are any questions.
Thank you. And our first question comes from the line of Jonathan Hayes.
Thank you for your time. So my question is kind of something I've heard on a few other calls in this space is there are managers who are actively holding, call it triple B, you know, double B quality paper, anticipating that they will dump that to buy lower credit quality on a pullback. Do you guys fall into that camp, or are you pretty well positioned the way you'd like to be positioned other than just changing out issues over the coming months?
So that is not something that we've discussed as part of our strategy. That's not to say we wouldn't do it, but we are not holding out. You know, the stuff we have that's rated triple B, we expect some spread tightening to drive total return. And it's, you know, what we focus on is triple B companies that are priced like double Bs, where the triple B universe, you know, just like we try to avoid defaults, the investment grade universe tries to avoid the fallen angels. So there's an opportunity when they become very cheap. They actually are cheap to high yield, and that's when we like to buy them. So it's not really part of our strategy. We think that, you know, in the riskier part of high yield in that distressed universe, you're going to see defaults really pick up. And if it does create some volatility in the asset class, which we are not anticipating, then we'll take advantage of that. But that's not our thought process. The double B stuff we expect, or triple B stuff that we own, we expect will generate total returns that will beat the high yield market.
And just a quick follow up to that question then. So I would presume I know the answer, but you guys at 300 and some odd million being fairly small, and you have at least a 10-year number on here, actually a 15-year number. Is that a function of distribution? And is that why you're partnered with Virtus? Or, you know, why is this, with the good performance numbers we see, why is this less familiar to me than I would expect?
Yeah, great question. I think that is a huge reason that we've partnered with Virtus. We haven't really had that distribution channel. So, and I think a lot of people like to see a seasoning period. So that at least has been communicated to me of 3 years. So we've been owned by Virtus for more than 3 years now. And you can see that the Virtus relationship has helped us. So, you know, hopefully that's not an impediment to anyone investing in the fund at this point.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we look for when we look to acquire managers, is, you know, a boutique manager that's focused on investing more than distribution, that has an asset base that has capacity as well as skilled investors with superior risk-adjusted returns over market cycles. So I agree that the long-term nature, the full market cycle, risk-adjusted excellence of the record, if they had more retail distribution going back, you know, 15 years plus, my guess is they'd have $10 billion plus in AUM. So we do see a lot of opportunity here to bring you an institutional quality high-yield manager, but with an asset base through which they can be more nimble, more selective, and meaningfully implement best ideas. So we're looking forward to that.
Thanks, guys.
And we do not have any further questions at this time.
Okay. I'm going to ask one last question, and then we'll wrap it up, Michael. You know, we talk about passive. You know, many advisors have been going and heavily using passive investing to keep overall costs down in a low return world. Some asset classes lend itself to passive investing more than others do. What is your feeling about high yield and passive investing, number one? And secondly, in a post-COVID world, we talk a lot this in equities, but I'm curious about high yield. Do you see more winners and losers in a post-COVID world, and how do you feel about how that relates to this active-passive discussion?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I always like to say you pay a high cost by investing in a high-yield ETF, and even though the fees, I mean, relative to active money managers really isn't that different, but that you tend to trade at a premium to NAV, and it's, if you just look at the performance of the ETF versus certainly our fund, and, you know, we have pretty consistent performance that's better. So I think that and the whole street knows what the ETFs are doing. So everyone, when they're buying, everyone front runs them. And when they're selling, everyone front runs them. So it's, you know, I don't think they get the best execution, that they keep cash balances low. So, you know, an active manager, our traders are very disciplined. When we set a buy, when we're going to put a new bond in the portfolio, they're very disciplined in what they're willing to pay. And it's certainly in this kind of environment where it was a hard stop to the economy, and as you mentioned, Barry, there's some significant winners and some that are really going to feel some pain through this. They're all in the ETF, and they're weighted based on whatever however the ETF decides to weight them, par amount outstanding,
right.
So or market value. So it's they own them all, and we're going to see defaults pick up, and you know that should be a headwind for performance of the ETFs.
So not a great time for autopilot, valuation agnostic, quality agnostic, balance sheet agnostic investing is what you're saying.
Definitely not.
Okay. Well, with that, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank you all for taking time out of your day to join us. For additional market commentary, any portfolio-specific insights, please visit our website at virtus.com. And if you have any additional questions or would like further information, please give us a call at 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. Mike, thanks again for your time, and everybody have a good, safe evening.
Thank you very much.